Hello everyone, welcome to the Stephen King Cast, one man's musings on the works of Stephen King. Each week I'll review one entry in the bibliography of Stephen King in the chronological order of publication, and just right off the bat, I just want to kind of give a technical note. Things might sound a little bit different. I'm recording in the living room today, and the dogs really haven't been getting a lot of love lately. With the baby taking up all of our attention, I feel like the dogs haven't really been getting the amount of attention that they used to be getting. So now I'm sitting with them on the couch, not in the basement, upstairs. There's windows, and they have a tendency to go insane whenever someone walks by. So you might be hearing the dogs much more vocally than typically on these episodes, but there's been a lot of feedback that the listeners of the Stephen King Cast really enjoy spending time with my dogs. So here's an opportunity for you guys to kind of get my living experience, what it's like to be the owner of two pugs. So just wanted to get that out of the way. So welcome back, everyone. I actually have a pretty fun announcement. This is the second podcast that I am recording today, but it's the first Stephen King Cast episode that I'm recording today, because earlier today I had a fantastic conversation with Hans and Lou from the Stephen King podcast, and I don't know when that episode's going up. It won't be going up on my feed. It will be going up on the Stephen King podcast, and that is definitely a podcast that everyone should be checking out, because, like I said, one of the two co-hosts is Hans, who happens to be the he runs the Stephen King resource website on the internet, and has been for, I think, since 1996, and that's Lilia's Library, Liljas library .com. It's a website that I have used for years. I want to say probably around the time the last three Dark Tower books were coming out, so 2003 to 2004 is when I really started getting into it, because at that point I was using the internet more, and I knew you could find information for upcoming things, whether it be movies or comics or what have you, on the internet. So, oh, that's just the Roomba. So I don't know why it's activating itself right now. I don't know. Maybe it's a singularity. Maybe the time has come. But I started looking for news as to what was happening in the world of Stephen King, and I found this website. I didn't find it. I mean, it's the number one website if you look for Stephen King news, and it's Lilia's Library, and it's been a part of my life ever since. So, I mean, it was awesome to sit down today and Skype with Hans and Lou. These two guys, they definitely know their stuff. We just had a great conversation about all the news, the Stephen King news recently, and we reviewed The Cookie Jar, Stephen King's newest short story, and then, we reviewed End of Watch. So it was just a really, really good conversation. Make sure that if you are listening to the Stephen King Cast, you should be listening to the Stephen King podcast as well. So subscribe to that. I don't know when that particular episode is going to show up, but it will, and it was a really good conversation, and I look forward to everyone hearing it. And I'm sorry about the Roomba, guys. The it's kind of a dumbass, and it doesn't know how to get back to its base. So hold on one second while I fix this this noisy issue in the background, and I'll be with you shortly. Okay, I helped Roomba get back to his base, so that shouldn't be an issue anymore. So going back to talking to Hans and Lou, like I said, great conversation. Subscribe to the Stephen King podcast. Frequent Lilia's Library as often as you can. They've Hans has been doing a great job at just posting all of the IT set photos and the Dark Tower set photos, and so that's definitely a site that you need to keep your eyes on. And you know, hopefully once I kind of figure out how to record things on my end, I would love to have the two of them come on the Stephen King cast for, you know, another special crossover episode. So it was good stuff, and you know, make sure that you you support those guys, because they've been doing it longer and better than I have. Okay, so with that, I am going to plug my own stuff. As you may know, I've been fortunate enough to have my own short stories published. I mean, we're not talking, you know, Stephen King quality, and we're not talking Stephen King quantity, but I'm pretty proud of what I've managed to get published. So in the pages of Dark Moon Digest, issue number 22, you can find my short story, Room 207. And that is the short story of a man driving down south to meet up with his wife because he has fear of flying. And so he's going to surprise her, but he needs to catch a few Z's, stops off in a local motel. And it's about what happens once he gets into that motel. Up next, we have Nine Tales Told in the Dark, issue number 9. My short story is This World Will Eat You All the Way Up. Two college friends, they're going cross-country after college, and they are discussing life. And one of the friends has is very interested in bringing up and talking about his friend's girlfriend. And there's a lot of kind of unspoken conversations between the two of them, and what happens when the unspoken becomes spoken. If you like witches, then you should check out Wax and Wayne, A Gathering of Witch Tales, in which you will find my short story, Hopscotch. Hopscotch is really about being 13, being a 13-year-old girl, and the vileness that 13-year-old girls can exhibit, and what happens when the evilness of a 13-year-old girl encounters a much stranger and much more credible evil. Then you can find in the pages of Trysts of Fate my short story Forget Me Not, and that is the metaphysical examination of identity in relationships and what happens when there is a breakup, what happens to one's identity. And lastly, coming soon in the pages of Skeptics Must Die, we have the short story The Portrait, and The Portrait examines two ghost hunters on a reality television show, a burgeoning one they're trying to get up off the ground. What happens when they head to a haunted house with a rumored haunted portrait, and what happens from there. So everyone, that's just a handful of short stories that you can find. You can find all of them on Amazon. And for everyone that has gone out and actually purchased these publications, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I know that a lot of you have gone out and picked up Dark Moon Digest number 22 for the short story 207. I know a lot of you have talked about that. So you know, feel free to pick up any of the others, and shoot me an email. Let me know what you think, because I can't grow as a writer if I don't get honest feedback. So thank you, everyone, for all the support. And up next, we have an email. No, we don't. We don't have an email. Why do I not have an email? Yes, I do have an email, and this is from Nate. And Nate writes, "Hello, fellow constant reader. Just a quick note to say thank you for the great podcast. I am new to podcasts, and yours is the first to truly draw me in. I'm the diehard fan that you described, actually doing a tattoo sleeve on my left arm commemorating Stephen King's works with original artwork infused with King's text." That's really cool. That's really cool. So, Nate, if you want to take a picture when the sleeve is done and send it, that's awesome. He continues, "I'm a 43-year-old male with a family of constant readers, my parents, sisters, and my wife and children. Having read some of his works many years ago, it's awesome to get a refresher from you and your insights into the works. On multiple occasions, your podcast has provoked thought, new perspectives, and discussion in my home. My favorite SK work is The Talisman Black House, with a Dark Tower series following closely behind. I was glad to see the most recent podcast from 6/25/16 when he sent this. I feared that you had concluded your series. I had just started listening in May of 2016. One question before I go. Did you really not like Heart-Shaped Box? Just curious, how did a review of this work by Joe Hill get passed over? It was a light and fast read, I get that, but it had such a coolness factor, and it was the first book in years that made me think about what might be under the bed when I awake in the middle of the night. Thanks again. Look forward to getting through all your podcasts, Nate. Nate, thanks for writing in. And in terms of Heart-Shaped Box, no, I love Heart-Shaped Box. I think that that's a great first novel from Joe Hill. For any author, for that to be a first novel is an incredible accomplishment. I don't know why I haven't reviewed it. I think that it is... I think that it has a very complex and dynamic and engaging main character. Just the fact that it's set in the rock and roll scene is, you know, distinguishes it. It gives it a little bit more of a stylistic edge over a lot of other horror genres that kind of take place in the everyday setting. And really, it just examines, you know, kind of love and perceptions and, you know, Judas Coin. First of all, what an awesome name, Judas Coin, for the main character. You know, I mean, him expressing guilt over how he treats himself and his, you know, his groupies and his fans. It's, there's a truth there to his pain. And it's unrelenting. The dead man's suit is such an incredible concept. So for those of you who haven't checked it out, you really should check out Heart-Shaped Box. It's a great, thrilling horror story that you all will enjoy if you like Stephen King and if you have liked the other works of Joe Hill that I reviewed here, Nosferatu and Horns, and I haven't had a chance to pick up The Fireman yet, but I will at some point. It's a hefty book. I picked it up in the store the other day. I didn't realize it was so long. But yeah, I'll definitely at some point I'll get around to Heart-Shaped Box, and at some point I'll get around to The Fireman as well. I look forward to Joe Hill books when they come out. The omission of Heart-Shaped Box is not an indication that I think negatively of Heart-Shaped Box. I think that Joe Hill is an incredible talent, a fantastic writer, and like I said, every novel that comes out that he publishes is definitely it's something to look forward to. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about today is Stranger Things Episode 3. I'm actually taking my time with these. I'm surprised that I don't know when the last episode came out. It feels like forever ago, but for those of you who are just tuning into this particular episode, what I've been doing, I've been examining Netflix's Stranger Things. I did kind of a general review, all thoughts kind of episode, and then I realized, you know what, I want to go back and watch every episode, so I might as well watch every episode and then share my thoughts on every episode. So I'm doing an episode-by-episode breakdown of Stranger Things, which takes us to episode 3. And so what I'm going to do now, I'm going to read from Wikipedia. The summaries are not as detailed as the summaries that I normally, you know, read on Wikipedia, but it kind of gives us a great idea as to what happened. So from here on out, please note that spoilers are on for what happens in this episode as well as later in the series. It is towards the end of August now. This dropped July 19th, and I know that 90% of the entire world seemed to watch Stranger Things in during that first weekend. But if by chance you haven't watched Stranger Things, you're really missing out. And there's been some kind of pushback on the show, as you're gonna get anytime it's something is universally beloved, about the setting and the nostalgia and blah blah blah, but if you're hearing any complaints, ignore the complaints. Just watch it. I guarantee you, if you like Stephen King, you're gonna love Stranger Things. I guess my only critique, and I posted this a mini rant on Facebook last week, is I just feel that in the conversation around Stranger Things, and that Stranger Things is discussed as being inspired by Amblin Films and early Spielberg. And that's certainly true, but if someone is going to give a deep dive review critique of Stranger Things and discuss the nostalgia factor and discuss Steven Spielberg, talk about Steven Spielberg and E.T. and talk about Steven Spielberg, if you don't mention Stephen King, it kind of invalidates the critique, because to me that's the more overt source of inspiration. I know that by, you know, the fact that it's an audio-visual story, I think that lends itself to a Steven Spielberg comparison. But make no mistake, I mean, in the interviews, the Duffer brothers, I don't know, they don't discuss Steven Spielberg nearly as much as they discuss Stephen King. So from the similar beats to from Firestarter and The Stand and It, and even Black House and Silver Bullet. I mean, Tommyknockers. These are the inspirations here. I don't, and maybe it's my own bias here, but I'm not a huge Goonies fan, so I just kind of bristle whenever anyone mentions the Goonies. So I don't know. I don't think Goonies. I think Losers. I don't think E.T. I think It. You know, I don't think Peter Coyote. I think The Shop. This is how my mind, you know, kind of works. You know, I don't think Indiana Jones. I think Alan Pangborn. Although I do think that Hopper is very much, especially when he starts, that sort of Chief Brody type of character, and that's definitely purposeful. They made sure that the uniforms kind of match the Amity Police. But anyway, I'm kind of going on a rant there. But go watch Stranger Things. That's the moral of the story. If you hear any negative criticisms, ignore it until you've watched it. Then make up your mind. But if you have kind of heard some scuttlebutt out there and been like, ah, nostalgia, I'm kind of over it, I don't really care, just watch it. You'll enjoy it. Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to read from Wikipedia, and then I'll get into my thoughts. So, Barb wakes up in the empty pool near a tall, dark creature. Climbing out, the world around her is completely different. Dark, colorless and covered in roots. Nancy notices Barb is gone, but she assumes she went home and has sex with Steve for the first time. Hopper goes to the laboratory and is told to speak to Rick Schaefer. After some insistence, a guard lets him through. The blacklight root substances is growing inside the lab. Alone in Mike's house, Elle remembers a supervised test in the lab. She crushes a Coca-Cola can with telekinesis and her nose begins bleeding. Joyce strings Christmas lights around her home, establishing communication with Will, who can turn them on and off. At the library, Hopper and deputies research Dr. Terry Brenner, the laboratory, and a woman who claimed her daughter was taken by scientists. Elle leaves Mike's house to meet the boys for another search and has another flashback in which she is instructed to inflict pain on a cat. Refusing, Dr. Brenner, whom she calls Papa, has put her in solitary confinement. In the struggle, she kills two guards, pleasing Brenner. At school, Nancy becomes worried about Barb. Steve and his friends discover Jonathan's photographs and destroy them along with his camera, but Nancy notices one of Barb at the pool moments before she disappeared. She returns to Steve's house to search for her. Nancy finds Barb's car and sees the creature in the woods. Nancy goes home, tearfully confessing to her mother that she lied about their whereabouts and is afraid for Barb. Joyce establishes a code with Will and the lights, which he uses to tell her that he is alive but unsafe. He tells Joyce to run as a creature begins to climb through her wall. Hopper tries to connect Brenner to Will's disappearance when he receives a radio call. Elle leads the boys to Will's house, claiming that he is hiding there, but the boys accuse her of lying. Will's body is discovered in a quarry. All right, so review. So it begins, and hey, guys, Barb isn't dead. I'm so glad that they decided to follow her, if only for a second, into the Upside Down. We're in episode 3 now, and this episode marks the turning point for the series. We can't dwell in the early stages of a mystery for too long. We have to start to peel back the mysteries to provide more information. Here, we learn that Barb wasn't necessarily killed, but taken to the Upside Down. So let's unpack what we learn here. So first, Barb is coughing up something. Is it water? It looks a little green. Her nose is bloody. She's wet. So I suppose that the monster dragged her into the pool? On the other side, there's no water, just the mold that's grown over everything. The particulates float through the air. The monster's in the pool with her. She tries to escape, but's dragged back into the pool. Juxtaposing Nancy's loss of virginity with Barb's abduction is haunting, to say the least, and very effective. It's Nancy's dream and Barb's nightmare. This is our first true glimpse of the Upside Down, which fans of Silent Hill might recognize. The idea that there's an alternate version of the world as we know it, a dark, empty version full of danger, and a very Silent Hill monster is terrifying, and it's a great look. I'll talk more about the Upside Down in the final episode, but now that we see what it's like, I want to commend the Duffer Brothers for this particular look of this alien world. If you guys hear a gross noise in the background, it's one of my dogs cleaning her paws. So I apologize. Nancy leaves, and when she arrives home, she faces something more frightening than the monster. A frightened, angry mother. And I feel bad for Mrs. Wheeler. I mean, she's trying so desperately to maintain a relationship with her children. But both of them, I mean, not just Nancy, but both of them are pushing her away. I mean, we later learn a little bit more of her through Nancy's perspective. And to know that she herself was just like Nancy must make this so painful for her. She settled into the role of the wife and mother for her dumbass husband. And to recognize her own youth in a daughter who is shutting her out makes her just incredibly sympathetic. We don't spend a lot of time with her, and there's been a lot of criticism that Cara Buono isn't given much to do. But her character isn't as one-note as has been discussed by some. I mean, does the actress get to flex major muscles here? No, but also this is a show that follows a handful of different perspectives. Her inclusion of this show is through her children's perspective. So the fact that the audience sees the actress as mom and kind of just mom, I think that's fitting for what the creators set out to do. So to me, that isn't a criticism that holds a lot of weight. Now, with all of that said, in season two, seeing as how we're peeling back more and more, if we don't get more of her as a character, now that she is involved, then I will join the criticisms. But until then, she's Nancy's mom. She is Mike's mom. That is her role. I mean, her husband is a non-entity in the show, and she is desperately trying to figure out what is occurring in the lives of her children. No, I'm sorry. She's not even desperately trying. She is kind of caught up in this little bubble, and she is brought to this larger world. Unlike Joyce, who is actively trying to find this larger world. I'm not talking about the Upside Down. I'm just talking to this greater mythology and mystery and conspiracy and magic and wonder. Like, you have one mother that is heading towards it on a purpose. She is proactive. There was an incident. Her son was taken. She needs to find her son. And then, Mrs. Wheeler, just things are different. She's just living her life. And her role is to be the mom of the two kids and to be the foil for Joyce. So now that we have an actress that is talented, I'd say that we see more of her as this particular character in season two with more to do. But in the meantime, I think that what she is doing in season one is fine. It's fine. So talking about the kids, they when we first see them, they start to pool their resources. And what I like here is that Lucas is the weapons expert. You know, he's bringing a knife from Nam, and don't call it a slingshot, the wrist rocket, which has a really fun payoff in the final episode. So they make plans with Elle to meet up after school to go on a mission to find Will. And I'm telling you guys, I don't know. I mean, I'm just loving this little romance between Mike and Elle. Finn Wolfhard is the man, and I look forward to seeing what he brings to the table in It. And, just the scenes here between, you know, him and Millie Bobby Brown. So, I mean, okay, let's talk about these names. Finn Wolfhard, Millie Bobby Brown. Two of the coolest names I've ever heard. And the fact that these two actors get to share screen time with each other, I mean, they just get to just drop the mic on everyone else around them, because there's not going to be a cooler pairing of actors than someone named Finn Wolfhard and Millie Bobby Brown. But the two of them acting off each other, they do it really well. The two of them play their parts so perfectly. You know, both are so tentative and so tender in their own ways, and so vulnerable, the two of them. As we'll see by the end of this episode, you'll see just how vulnerable these two are. We just know by the very genre that we're working in, this romance can't last. It can only be something that, you know, they kind of dream of, but the dream will never actually come to reality. But going back to Finn Wolfhard, for those of you who don't know, I mean, he's playing Richie Tozier in It, and I really look. I didn't even talk about the big news, guys. I'm sorry. Interjecting here, I'll get back to Finn in a second. Really buried the lead. And I talked about this with Hans and Lou. So if you want like a real detailed conversation about this, make sure that you listen to the Stephen King podcast. But Entertainment Weekly released the full image of what Pennywise looks like in It. And I strongly recommend all of you go out, not just look at the picture, because a lot of people are going to make up their minds right away based on that picture. But I think that you need to make up your minds, not necessarily on the picture, but I think that everyone needs to read the article that accompanies it as well, because when you read the article, there is a thorough explanation of the costume by the costume designer that really gives an insight into the rationale and sort of the themes that they're playing with in this movie. So for those of you who might not like the look, just with a knee-jerk reaction, and you haven't read the article yet, please read the article, because it actually might make you change your mind. With something this thought out, you really have to give them credit. So I really like the look personally. For everyone that has listened to my reviews of It, knows that what I think is terrifying about the clown is that he lures you in. He looks like a clown. He looks like a normal clown in all the places the clown should not be. And this movie is definitely not doing that. But with that said, you know what? I'm fine with it as long as whatever they're doing is done well. And I think this is a very distinct looking clown. And we need a distinct looking clown. So anyway, once Lou puts up the episode, make sure that you tune in, because, you know, we have a really good conversation around the look of the new Pennywise in the movie It, which, going back to Stranger Things, stars Finn Wolfhard. And, you know, I mean, in this show, he's playing a Bill Denbro type character. When I first discovered that he was playing Richie, I was kind of curious about that, because I just see him really as Bill. But there's definitely scenes, especially in this episode, where he has a quick-witted mania that makes him perfect for Richie. And I'm really, really looking forward to it. So Hopper and his two sidekicks head to the Hawkins lab and are stopped by the security guard. Hopper explains the rationale for investigating, and the guard tells him he needs to contact Rick Schaefer at the Department of Energy. Here's the thing. We certainly don't meet this character in this season. If Dr. Brenner does indeed die at the end of the season, it means that we'll need someone to fill that role. So I wouldn't be surprised if we meet this Rick Schaefer, who makes a personal visit to Hawkins, Indiana, to figure out what went wrong with the experiments. And from what I understand, there's been some kind of whispers online, and I need to check this out again, gives me another reason to watch this show. But I guess in the last episode, there is a newspaper article. So after the events have concluded, I believe it's probably at the police station. Hopper has a board with all of the news articles about what kind of occurred. And I guess there's a quote by Dr. Brenner, which would indicate that Matthew Modine is still alive and kicking on the show, which I think is great news. Great news. So I want to see more Brenner. But at the same time, if his boss shows up, I wouldn't be surprised if that boss is Rick Schaefer. So in this scene, I mean, Hopper is just incredibly convincing. I mean, he persuades Patrick, the guard, to at least speak to his supervisor. And he's not threatening. He's not intimidating. That's going to come later. But instead, he uses compassion. And his two deputies, meanwhile, continue their comedy act. And I've talked about this before. I just really like that they're kind of in their own movie. And I would like to see an episode that just follows the two of them having these like bumbling kind of dim-witted adventures. Within the house, with the house to herself, Elle does a little exploring and watches TV. And unfortunately for her, this prompts a flashback to a very Firestarter-esque experiment in which she's forced to crush a Coke can with her mind as Brenner and a group of eager scientists watch through a pane of safety glass. In the buyer's home, Winona creates perhaps the show's most iconic image, maybe? The strung-up Christmas lights. And after having faced down a monster and convinced her son is stuck elsewhere, she has developed more of a backbone and isn't having it when her boss begins to hum and haw as she purchases more Christmas lights. In the lab, Hopper gets a tour after he asks to see the tapes. And it's interesting. It'd be easy for the head of the place to simply say no, but this is an organization that's big on appearances. They don't want to alienate the local police, because if they push him away, it's only going to prove that they have something to hide. At the end of this episode, they'll plant a fake body to attempt to put an end to the Will Byers mystery so they can hunt for the creature without obstruction. Yet by bringing Hopper into the lab, they unknowingly cause more problems for themselves, as he quickly deduces that the tape they show is not of the night in question. Hopper now knows that they're lying. In the bowels of the lab, where the giant tendrils pulse, the scientists install a winch for what will lead to an expedition to the Upside Down. And it won't end well for the foolish scientist. The quick moments we spend with learning about the lab or this gateway are so tantalizing. Hey guys, if you at this point hear a little bit a difference in the audio, it's because I just stopped. Well, not I just stopped, but as you're listening, I did stop the recording because my wife and child came home and I wanted to spend time with them. So I shut down, turned off, and then 2 days later I decided to start recording again. I'm in a different location in the house. So if all of a sudden it just, boom, sounded different, that's the reason why. But picking up where I left off, Elle continues to explore the house and she enters Nancy's room. Now, whether she knows it or not, she is investigating here and being surrounded by the life that she was denied. And it is heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking to watch her. You know, she sees this life of a happy girl, just living in a John Hughes teenage dream movie. And she herself is Charlie McGee from Firestarter. And speaking of Nancy, she's eating with Steve and his monstrous friends. 3 episodes in, we can see that Steve is beginning to see them for who they are. It's brief, but it's there. There's this look of disgust on his face. And it doesn't last long in this scene, but he'll come around eventually. And, you know, I've definitely, you know, read reviews where people still just don't like Steve. And I think that that's because of how he presented himself at the beginning of the series. But I'm telling you, I'm pretty team Steve. I like where he winds up. And so I like watching his arc. And during recess, Lucas really sticks it to Mike, giving him a hard time about L. Troy and his henchmen show up and they go for the jugular, telling them that Will is probably dead. God, these kids suck. And to make matters worse, they trip Mike, who has a pretty painful chin smash, onto a rock. Dustin continues to play the sensitive, thoughtful one who dusts him off and cheers him up. Meanwhile, Jonathan, the dummy, develops the photos he took the night before in the dark room at school during class. He's spotted, and we know this isn't going to end well. Hop, meanwhile, heads to the library, and he wants to do some research on the Hawkins lab and runs afoul of his lady friend, the librarian. Hop learns a little bit more about Brenner and MK Ultra, which you can read about on Wikipedia. And I strongly recommend everyone go and do that right now. Karen Wheeler with her sidekick Holly. I love this kid, by the way. And I definitely want to see more of Holly explored in the next season. Just seeing things through her eyes. Just give me an episode through Holly's eyes. And like what kind of craziness she experiences but never talks about and isn't really involved with. But anyway, Karen and Holly visit Joyce. And Holly follows the blinking lights to Will's room. And it's a magical little moment where the lights are flashing all around her before stopping altogether. The monster then starts to emerge from the wall and stops because... reasons? Because Joyce walks into the room, I guess? I mean, so this is... there's no real reason. And based on what we know about the monster, there's no reason for him to have stopped coming through the wall. It's not as if he's trying to hide. This was definitely a scene that works in the moment but doesn't work long-term if you think too much or really contextualize this with how what we know of the monster. And then Nancy starts to see if she can find out what happened to Barb, and nobody cares about Barb. Poor Barb. I saw this drawing online. I shared it on my Instagram. I can't remember who the artist is, and it's on Twitter as well. I can't remember who the artist is off the top of my head, but I the artist information is on the Instagram. But it's Will and Barb. It's a drawing of Will and Barb sitting next to each other, and it's just everybody shouting for Will. It's like, Will, where are you? We love you. And poor Barb is just sitting next to him, and no one's crying or screaming for Barb. And it's just a twist of the knife that no one cared about Barb. And right now there's this whole thing called Justice for Barb online, which is a little ridiculous. A lot of people online are treating Barb like she was an actual person that isn't really being thought of, or not much is being, you know, done. And like, yes, within the show, you know, Barb, there's no vigil for Barb. Like, no one seems to be looking for Barb, and I get that. But whatever, like, this is not a show about Barb, and Barb is, whether you like it or not, she is a horror movie victim. It's what she is. I mean, this is the genre that we're playing with, and what we get with the breakdown of these characters, we get Will, and we see, you know, Will is our snowball. He's our inciting incident. He's our catalyst here. And so all the tension is on Will, but as we learn by the end of the season, like six people, I believe, have gone missing within the span of this week. So we start to like really see how people are just going missing. So we go from, you know, the emotional, like, oh my God, where is Will? We're all invested in Will. We all believe in Will, to Barb. We know Barb. This is too bad about Barb, but there's not as much an investment, to just unknowns. So you can see this degression of the victims, and we see how Barb fits into that. So Jonathan is then intercepted, as we knew that he would be, by Steve and his gang. Now, we're sympathetic for Jonathan because we get that he's a good kid. He's clearly going through a lot, but look at this from Steve's perspective, guys. I mean, this is a weirdo that was creeping around the woods taking pictures of his girlfriend changing. Like, this is extremely skeevy behavior. So as much as we might want to vilify Steve in this moment, come on. You have to admit. I mean, he's got a point to smash this camera. It's a dick move, don't get me wrong, because it's all that Jonathan has. You know, but does Steve know that? Does Steve even need to know that? I mean, I get both sides here. And he is a dick. Through and through, he's being a dick about it. And I get why Steve does it. But in a few episodes, I also see why Jonathan does beat the shit out of him, because he is being such a dick in this moment. But so, yeah, like I said, I think they do a good job at showing both sides. And I like the fact that Jonathan isn't just like, oh, sensitive Jonathan. Like, that was some stalker creepy behavior. Elle leaves the house to meet up with the boys, and as she's waiting, she spots a cat, which triggers our next flashback. It's a natural progression from the Coke can, and it's very difficult to watch. Eleven is crying, refuses to hurt the cat, and she's punished for it. It's similar to a previous flashback where we saw her thrown into the locked room. Here, she's not having it. And while she might not have wanted to kill the cat, she doesn't have the same qualms about killing the men who are imprisoning her. It's two brutal deaths, by the way. This whole scene is done just so well. And after she kills the men, she starts to cry. Dr. Brenner strokes her face like a proud father. And in that moment, she seems overcome with remorse, deep sadness, and gratitude that her father figure is showing affection. It's such a telling glimpse of her sad, sad life. And it's so chilling to watch him carry her in his arms past the dead bodies. The tenderness juxtaposed with the horror. It shows how twisted and entangled this man is in her life. And I love watching this and trying to just figure out what's going on in his head. Does he really care for her from a parental standpoint? Or is he just playing the part to, you know, to mollify her, to pacify her, to coax the results out of her that he wants? That's why I want him to be alive, because now that we've kind of seen him as the mystery figure, let's start to really understand who Martin Brenner is. Elle and the boys make their way through the woods to try and find Will, while Nancy ditches her new friends to try and find Barb. I like that Nancy has some sense about her, that she isn't just a damsel in distress or a shallow teen in a romantic comedy. While in the woods beyond Steve's house, she sees the monster run past. We catch the briefest of glimpses. She doesn't see much either, and in a creepy description, she says it doesn't have a face. While the monster is elsewhere, Will takes the opportunity to communicate with his mother using the Christmas lights. Using one blink for yes and two for no, we learn that he is not safe, which is a chilling realization. Could you imagine being Joyce in that moment? Nothing that you can do? She needs more answers, so she paints the wall underneath the bulbs to create an alphabet that she'll be able to use to communicate in more detail. Back at the library, Hopper is onto something when he deduces that Will unfortunately happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, when they get the call to what becomes the darkest moment of the series and the most haunting. The discovery of what we're led to believe at the moment is the body of Will Byers. In the woods, as night has fallen, Elle has brought the boys back to Will's house. Keep in mind that at that moment in the Upside Down, Will is at that house because he's communicating with Joyce. So Elle is 100% right. She just can't cross over into the Upside Down. They spot the police roaring down the road and they hop on their bikes to follow. As I stated a second ago, Will is communicating using the lights, stating that he's right here and that Joyce should run. The second he's finished, the wall bursts and the monster finally pushes through. This whole sequence, perfect. Keeps cutting between her to Hopper to the boys. The kids riding through the woods at night. It just looks spectacular. And when Hopper arrives at the water's edge, when he says, "Please don't tell me it's the kid," he says it as a person, not as a cop. No doubt from the memory of losing his daughter. But it's touches like this that make the show stand out. The body's pulled from the water. The music starts. It's a beautiful rendition of David Bowie's Heroes by Peter Gabriel. Hopper has to walk away. The kids look in growing disbelief. Mike loses it on Elle, and the one friend she had in the whole wide world turns on her. Him saying, "What's wrong with you?" is more painful than watching them pull the body from the water. Mike races home and cries in his mom's arms while Jonathan and Joyce embrace as the police arrive to tell him the news. It was the most unexpected ending to the series during the first watch. I don't think any of us expected the characters to discover the body of Will Byers. Granted, it isn't really Will, but at that moment we're supposed to believe it is, and it's treated with the weight of this discovery, and I think that it was a ballsy move. I love the Duffer Brothers for it. And then exploring the body in a later episode is just one of the goofiest, silliest, most fun moments of the series. So that's my review of episode 3. Sorry it took so long, guys. But here it is. I hope you enjoyed. I don't know when episode 4 review will be coming out. I just have to find time to actually record the episode. I'm trying to squeeze in these recordings as quickly as possible. As I've said before, it's a little bit more difficult, but whatever. So in terms of what I had talked about with the Stephen King podcast visit that I had, I was fortunate enough to be on their podcast. I believe that's coming out this weekend. So just follow my social media accounts or follow Stephen King podcast social media accounts to tune in for that episode. It was a lot of fun, and I look forward to having the guys on my episode as well. So, or on my podcast. All right, guys, I think that is it for now. So I guess I'll see you when I see you. And may you have long days and pleasant nights. And I'll see you here next time where M-O-O-N spells Stephen.
I can remember standing by the wall, and the guns shot above our heads, and we kissed as though nothing.